I'm Esther Kostanowitz, and my favorite thing is Star Wars.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello, good evening. If it's evening where you are, this is Leah Jones. I'm the host of Finding Favorites. This week on the podcast, today is Sunday, July 26th, and we are going to be diving into a conversation I had in June, on June 30th, with Esther Kostanowitz. Esther is a writer and journalist based in Los Angeles, and we have been friends going back to the earliest days of Jewish blogging. So we probably met online in 2004, 2005, met in person soon after that at a blogging event that I got to organize for One Voice, which was a peace-seeking organization, an Israel-Palestine two-state solution organization. Back in the day, I got to organize an event for One Voice with Arianna Huffington and Craig Newmark at a little cool space in Manhattan. And Esther was on the list, and that was the very first time we met in person. We've been friends ever since. We see each other sometimes when we're traveling on the Jewish conference circuit. And if I'm ever in LA and she's ever in Chicago, then we make a point to have a meal or more together. Esther, like I said, she's a writer and journalist. You can catch her at Limud, which is a Jewish learning conference. She does a lot of classes called TV Gone Jewy, where she explores the increase in Jewish representation in TV and movies and media in the last few years. So that's a lot of what you can find her talking about at conferences, at virtual conferences, online, in her podcast called The Bagel Report. So when I asked Esther to join me for this podcast and talk about favorite things, I've been in her house. I've seen her BB-8 collection, and I had a suspicion Star Wars would be the thing that we talk about. It's nice to have an excuse to get on the phone with a dear friend and talk to them for an hour or more. This was probably 90 minutes that I cut down to an hour for this podcast. So know that Esther had a lot more to say, and I'm trying to respect the format of a 1 hour podcast. So there were really wonderful extra commentary about, we talked about the hero's journey, origin stories, but there wasn't room for everything in this conversation about Star Wars. I hope that everyone is still able to stay home and stay safe. Keep washing your hands, keep wearing masks, and keep those indoor hobbies going. Have a great week. Hello and welcome to Finding Favorites. I am your host, Leah Jones. This is the podcast where we talk about people's favorite things and we get recommendations without an algorithm. Today, I am joined by my dear friend, Esther Kostanowitz. Hi, Esther.
Hi.
I'm now going to embarrass Esther by reading her bio in front of her, but it's not embarrassing because she's amazing and she knows it. Esther Kostanowitz is a writer, editor, and consultant. She is a regular contributor at the Los Angeles Jewish Journal and at The J, which is the Jewish Weekly of Northern California. You can find her on iTunes and Stitcher and all those good podcast apps, where she's a co-host of The Bagel Report, which is a podcast about Jews and entertainment. And she is a casual scholar of hashtag TV Gone Jewy. You can find her at Limuds, both online and offline, around the world, helping us talk about the best moments and the increase of Jewish content on TV. She was the founding editor of Grok Nation and has written all across the internet. And you can find more about her at EstherK.com or on Twitter, where she is known as Esther K. So, hello, Esther. How are you?
Yeah. Hi. It's so good to be here with you. This is so long overdue. You're starting a podcast.
It took me a while to land on a topic. So, but yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited to join the world of the podcast hosts.
It is a glamorous world. I hope you're ready.
It is glamorous indeed. How are things out in LA? How are you getting through these quarantine times?
You know, this time is like, it's like nobody's really okay. But among the people who are not okay in the world, I'm one of probably the more okay. Somebody who was a freelance writer and consultant beforehand, I'm not mourning the loss of an office because I never really had one. It's all virtual office. I'm good at, you know, kind of carving out time in my life to do my work, which, you know, so the WFH work from home nation that is all like having trouble adjusting, that really isn't me. I've always been working from home. So, and my health is good, thank God. And, you know, my family so far seems to be healthy and safe. And so, you know, at this point, like that's the base, you know, the Maslow needs are taken care of. You know, it's like shelter, fine. My work's been good and even increasing during this time as people try to figure out, you know, content needs and how they want to communicate. And as a journalist, you know, reporting on things in the world that are happening. I'm not the person who's going to report on the newest medical advances or who's going to get this vaccine first, but like I'm really more of a reporter on human response and reaction and culture and how those elements respond to crisis. So to be in that business and to be able to bring those stories to people and various news outlets is a privilege, and I'm very lucky.
Is there a story that you've reported on that has been like the most surprising for you so far?
Well, I'm always impressed when people are managing to pivot in new and exciting ways. That's kind of become the official word of this time is pivot. You know, I have a friend who runs a bakery here, BB's Bakery.
Is that the one, I think you maybe posted, they did cookies, smiley face emoji cookies wearing masks?
Yes, exactly. I mean, they've been doing like a number of pivots. I mean, at the core of it all, they're still just a very small neighborhood bakery that specializes in Israeli kind of food. But, you know, they've kind of, because the owner is like very creative and is good with a pivot. You know, he started creating make your own cookie kits at home so that like parents have something, an activity to do with their kids. Similarly, pizza kits. He's got like muffins, chocolate chip muffins that double chocolate chip muffins that were apparently a recipe from Camp Ramah. So all the Camp Ramah people who can't go to Camp Ramah because it's closed are actually buying the muffins, which are basically cupcakes. I mean, they are the same, right? Basically.
Once you make it a double chocolate chip muffin, it goes into cupcake territory.
I feel like if you threw any fruit in there or any like whole grain oats, you could call it a muffin. But as soon as it crosses over a sugar and dessert threshold, I don't know.
I bet there's secret zucchini in it.
I know. I mean, yeah, my mom used to make that like zucchini bread every once in a while, and people would eat it and love it until they realized it was made of zucchini. Yeah. Anyway, this bakery is, I think, doing really well. Like you said, they have these mask cookies, and I don't know if they're doing really well, like they're thriving in quarantine. It's still like really hard to run a business. But I'm always impressed at the enthusiasm behind the mini pivots that are trying to help get through a time, and also by the community response to something that's beloved, you know, and trying to help somebody out. So I like stories that kind of follow that, you know, where everybody acts with the best of intentions and and what is returned to them is love and acceptance. And that's not every story, obviously, but the ones that are, I think, are very important now, because there's a lot of negativity out there in the internet, in the streets, and everybody hates everybody for everything. And so like when you can find these moments where it's just about love and support, I think those are really moving stories.
I love it. Yeah, I live down the street from a really popular brunch spot, and they have they've put up a sign. They're like, we are not reopening indoor seating. We're sticking to carry out. We are, and this is their big pivot. I mean, this was a place with like a 45 minute line. I was part of the solo diner crew. There was that was able to get in on the counter. They were able to turn over solo seats on the counter really quick for us. But yeah, their pivot to saying like, we're not going to try and pretend that it's safe. We're just going to stick to carry out. in other neighborhood spots that are really trying to figure out, like, how do you make it work? And it's been remarkable to see the creativity shine through on how local businesses are making it.
This is like unlike any other time that I imagined that I'd be living through in my life. And, you know, I think about my nieces and nephews and like what they're experiencing. And I feel like for the most part, their parents are helping them keep it normal-ish. But how normal can it be when they're spending their entire school year at home? Or, you know, one of my brother's kids are in Israel. And so in Israel, they had like a kind of like, yay, it's over. And then they're like, oh no, here it is, it's back again kind of situation. So like nobody in my family was ill, but a couple of people in my family were quarantined because they were in the same space with other people who were ill. So like, it's just like that kind of, you know, I feel like everybody's got to do what they can to stay safe. But I do understand like the cabin fever of everything and not really wanting to get back out there and get back to normal. Like if we have to cancel 4th of July, if we have to cancel Rosh Hashanah, like I'm not like so radical, but like if we have to cancel, if canceling Rosh Hashanah would like make everybody in the world better immediately, I would be like, totally cancel Rosh Hashanah.
So here's the thing. If we cancel Rosh Hashanah and it means more people are sealed in the book of life.
Right.
Right. Then we've done our job.
Right.
And it's, I mean, that's a questionable theology. I understand. But like, yeah, we put saving lives ahead of all else. It is wild to me as a president of a synagogue who's helping make these decisions about when do we get to pray in person, mm-hmm. and looking at churches and other houses of worship that are so anxious to get back in the building. And I just can't square it with the Jewish belief that saving lives is the most valuable, most important mitzvah.
Yeah, above like everything.
Above everything. It makes it a very easy decision to make, to say the lives of my congregants and the communities they live in is more important than in-person prayer at this time. The concept of this podcast is everybody has a favorite something that has great stories attached to it. And so what is your favorite thing that we're here to talk about today?
So when we first started talking about this, I was like, well, I could do pop culture, I could do writing. And then you're like, no, be more specific. So I was like, okay, fine. And I think, you know, I started thinking, I considered The Wizard of Oz for a while and Gone with the Wind, which were two of my favorite movies growing up, which is like strange, you know, strange duo. And also I was not born in the 1930s and 40s. So why that was true, I'm not really sure. Wizard of Oz is a little bit more understandable, I think.
They were both, you know what, they were both... Wizard of Oz was on TV every year. It was an annual event in my family, at least. The Wizard of Oz being on TV was a appointment television, mm-hmm. when it was like appointment television was a daily thing. So Wizard of Oz, I think, makes 100% sense. Mm-hmm. And also, like, I don't think anyone went to a grade school without a Wizard of Oz play that they could have been a part of at least once, if not five times growing up.
Right.
And Gone with the Wind was at one point, I think, like the only movie that Turner Classic Movies owned. And so when we were growing up, Gone with the Wind was on TV a lot.
That's true.
Because Turner didn't have many movies yet. Right. It was like Gone with the Wind and, Arsenic and Old Lace. I think they were on a rotation.
I feel like Rear Window got added at some point, but
yeah. It did.
I mean, I think, you know, you talked about The Wizard of Oz being appointment television, and quite honestly, it's very interesting that when I was growing up, same time as you were growing up, I couldn't make that appointment because almost always the it was on either on a Friday night or during one of the days of Passover. So I like was very upset every year that we had to miss it. And I don't know how I got to watch it otherwise. There must have been like some, it wasn't really video rental. Maybe it was a VHS. I don't know. But I did get to see it a couple of times. And then like when it was on TV subsequently, I kept missing it. So I ended up writing a letter when I was younger to Turner to ask them to pick a different date. They did not, but now we all have streaming and can see everything whenever we want. So you can thank me later. I'm sure that was all because of my letter that I wrote when I was like 8 years old.
I'm sure it was. So if we're not here to talk about pop culture, Gone with the Wind, or The Wizard of Oz.
Right. I mean, I think anyone who knows me is going to know that it is Star Wars that we're here to talk about.
I have heard of Star Wars.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen a Star War?
I have seen a Star War. I just today listened to the final episode of Lauren Lapkus and Nicole Byers' podcast about Star Wars.
Oh, I don't even know about that.
Oh my gosh. It is called, it is phenomenal, because they had never seen it. Neither of them had ever seen
it. Oh, really?
And so they're going through, it's called Newcomers. Mm. And so season one is Star Wars. So the two of them had only, maybe each of them had seen one movie. They had picked up all these pop culture references. Because you can't go through life and go through UCB without hearing Luke, I am your father.
Right.
Or about Jar Jar Binks. Or
The Force will be with you.
The Force will be with you. But neither of them had ever watched it. So they watched all the movies in release order. So starting with A New Hope. So they watched them in year order, not in movie order.
Right.
And then they watched like Clone Wars and Mandalorian, and today the final episode was Spaceballs.
Nice.
So my most recent Star Wars intake has been two comedians who have never seen it talking about it, and me not watching the movies to follow with their podcast.
Got it.
So, but this podcast isn't actually a review of a podcast of two comics who never saw it. It's a conversation with you about Star Wars as your favorite thing.
Right, but like a podcast within a podcast is like a continuation of the Shakespearean tradition of a play within a play. So
absolutely.
I think we're okay. We're very literary, in fact. So yeah, I think Star Wars is like one of those things that like, it's just been kind of like a track throughout my life, and I didn't really expect it would be. I would say that I was probably more of a super fan of The Wizard of Oz when I was younger, but when I did see Star Wars in the movie theaters, I don't remember what year, but it was also like something that we watched on HBO like a bunch of times. And we taped it from TV when it was on VHS. And I have two younger brothers, both of whom were super into it also. So we watched it a lot together. And, you know, for the three of us I'm 3 and 6 years older than my brothers. So if the three of us could agree on something to watch together, you know, in a world where there was one TV per household, you know, it was a good thing. Yeah.
And is your love of Star Wars expansive, like the whole canon and now what Disney calls legends? Is it the first, is it the three movies from the 70s and 80s? Is it the nine? Like, what is your, when you look at, like, when you say, now I've been to your house and I have seen that you have a number of BB-8s.
Yes.
So I suspect you also like modern Star Wars. Uh-huh. But when you say I love Star Wars, tell me about, like, what's your catchment area? What does that include?
It's an excellent question. You know, I would say that I am not orthodox. I am more conservative, or, you know, less, not reform Star Wars fan, but like, not that there's anything wrong with that.
So you're like maybe conservadox?
Maybe. I mean, if orthodox is people who like dress up and go to Comic-Con every single year and wait outside for panels and things like that, if that's orthodox, I'm not that. I would say I am a solid fan, but I'm not, and sometimes a fangirl, but not always. I think that my catchment areas, as you so put it, so nicely put it, is the original three movies, and the new movies, the last three. The prequels, I watched.
Skip over the mess of the 90s.
They were definitely a mess. It doesn't mean I didn't watch them, and it doesn't mean that I haven't seen them more than once. But there are parts of those movies that are super painful. Any of the romance is just like, I feel like the Fred Savage character in The Princess Bride, where he's like, is this a kissing book? You know, it's just like, so it doesn't, the chemistry doesn't seem to work. And like, you know, I just want the story. Like the prequels are supposed to be like, how does a good guy turn bad?
Right.
That's something that's like very like interesting to watch. I mean, it's, you know, it's Breaking Bad. It's Better Call Saul. It's, you know, things not set in that universe.
Right.
But like everybody wants to know how, it's an origin story, a hero origin story or a villain origin story. They're interesting because how does somebody who's on one path end up choosing another? And often the answer is love or loss. And that's a very human kind of area to explore. So I appreciated that part of it, but like there are parts of it that just seemed like too much. If you also look at just in terms of the chronology of those movies, the first set of movies, you know, started in 1977, came out in 1977, 1980, and 1983.
Yep.
And then like, I don't even remember, sometime in the 90s when the prequels came out. And
it was a solid 10, it was at least 10 years between... Is Empire the third, or is Return of the Jedi? Between Return of the Jedi and the first prequels is at least a decade, if not more.
Right. Yes. And like, it's so funny to think about a decade, because I feel like as I get older, a decade means less and less. And also now time has no meaning. So I don't know how that's going to shake out.
I have no concept of it. We've been home since March, and it is June 30th. Time has, there's today, tomorrow, and the past. That's all right. I can handle right now. Okay. Let's go back to...
Look, it's all part of the way we live and think now. Like, we're very easily distracted by our predicament. But, back to the prequels. So, like, when those movies came out, everybody was super excited. But one of the things that didn't match was now Lucas had all of these, technical things he could play with to increase the quality of the graphics. So like, it looked like it was shot, like it was more intricate and more busy in the background. And there was a lot more like space creatures, and because everything was done digitally, which they didn't have the opportunity to do with the first trilogy. So that also was kind of like a tonal mismatch. Now he had the toys. He wanted to play with them, which I get.
Right, because the prequels were shot 10 to 15 to 20 years after the original movies.
Right.
But they are set
20 years
before. Yeah.
Yeah, about 20 years before. So, like, it doesn't make sense. It's like saying, you know, I guess now from 2000, the year 2000 to now, right? So... that's the span of time, and technology in that time is probably less stark in terms of the changes than from 1980 to 2000. So I mean, look, my analysis is very non-scientific, but it's just in terms of how it made me feel and how, you know, my observation of it was that it was a tonal mismatch.
Right. Cause there were things. So in today's finale of Newcomers, Nicole and Lauren had on the actor who played Jar Jar Binks.
Yes, who, Ahmed Best.
Yes, and he's the first person to ever do motion capture for a movie. And he talked about being on stage or on set with Frank Oz, who was playing Yoda with a puppet. But if I understand correctly, George Lucas swapped out puppet Yoda, who is beloved, mm-hmm. with a CGI Yoda. So even though Frank Oz was on set and it was puppet Yoda, or I'm sorry, Muppet Yoda, which is feels so real, he swapped him out for a CGI Yoda because the toys were there.
Right.
So it really loses that pra-
practical magic of the first show, of the first three movies. That so much more was practical.
Yeah. I mean, they're, you know, Yoda does have a moment that kind of makes you forget about that a little bit. Like, you know, you get to, you're used to in the first, you know, in Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, Yoda is an old man, an old puppet. he's an old, whatever his species is. You know, if in The Mandalorian, they refer to, you know, Baby Yoda as the child. They don't call him Baby Yoda because Yoda's a name. It's not the species. We don't know what the species is called. So so if
it seems like a weird thing to hold out on after 40 years.
Yes,
43 years. Like, how have we still not named this species? And aren't there still only like three of his species that have ever been seen?
I think
there's
so.
There's the child. There's Yoda. And then I think there's a Lady Yoda in maybe the Christmas special.
Right. Well, at some point there was a Lady Yoda, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
So anyway, I'm not one to speculate about about the romantic life of a Jedi elder.
Yes.
But, you know, assuming that you know, there is a... Oh, wait, are we still talking about how Yodas procreate? Is that where I landed?
That's where we landed.
But anyway,
gender identification and sexuality and reproductive lives of the species of Yoda. So, okay, so your catchment area, your world of Star Wars are the original three and the modern three.
Right.
Are there any books, comic books, TV shows, animated TV shows in the mix for you in addition to those six movies?
Thank you so much for asking. Yes, there were, but not until later. I think that, like, one of the things that the franchise started to kind of tilt toward the finale of the Skywalker saga with the final three movies. You know, there have been cartoons, there's been like Rebels and the Clone Wars, which continued the story of that world, of that universe, the Skywalker kind of centered universe. And I didn't really get into those so much. I saw a couple of them on a plane, and one of them was like really, really good. It was like had deep story and emotional pathos and real, like, you know, real character dilemmas. And the other one was just kind of like droids being idiots. And I spoke to a friend of mine who's like who's an expert on both of those series, the Rebels and Clone Wars. And she says that there is a mix of those episodes. So, like, you know, if you just watch a couple of disembodied ones, you could end up with like droids falling on their faces and then people laughing at them, or you could end up with somebody who has to save the galaxy and doesn't know if he's worthy. And like, that's, you know, a Jedi has to betray her master and doesn't know if she can do it, but she knows she has to. So, and that there are more women characters. So, like, you know, it's a question. I haven't really delved into that because, I don't know, I guess maybe it's the format. Maybe if it was live action, I would have gone through it quicker, than a cartoon,
sure,
or animation or whatever. But, a friend of mine also turned me on to the novels, and it's not like I know them all by any means, but there were two that I read, which are kind of Leia focused, she's always been kind of a touchstone for me in this series because, you know, she was a brunette princess who didn't take any crap from anybody. She was a senator also. So it's not like she was just a princess who like had her hair up in the, you know,
in the buns,
some sort of, I mean, she's got two buns, we know that very well, but, and she did occasionally have princess hair, but it was like more in the way, it was less part of who she wanted to be and more of who she had to be by position of her rank. And so I always wanted more Leia, you know. She literally rescues everybody in the movie, like all the time.
Yeah, she's like the Hermione Granger of Star Wars, or who was Inspector Gadget's niece, Penny, I think, right? The smart brunette, the smart girl who saves other people, and then the guys get the glory.
That's right.
It's a fantasy, right, where that happens. That's not real life at all.
Right.
Did that register as sarcasm? I hope it did. Hope it registered as dripping in sarcasm.
It was dripping.
Just checking.
Totally. And I think that part of that is the character, but part of it is also Carrie Fisher and who Carrie Fisher became after the movies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the sharp, snarky, independent writer who just like kind of told Hollywood to go F itself at various points. Obviously, she had a lot of drug problems also, but she was a brilliant, brilliant writer. And
yeah, wasn't she the person who saved scripts? Like, yes. Wasn't she the person you hired to save a script?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I don't know the whole list of the ones that she did because she's not credited on a lot of them. But certainly, you know, Postcards from the Edge was about her and her relationship with her mother. And she did some work on that, became friends with Meryl Streep. And then Meryl Streep, when she was at the Oscars the year that Carrie Fisher died, quoted her as one of the things she likes to say is take your broken heart and make it into art. And so that was just always kind of like a beautiful phrase that I've kind of held on to ever since Carrie died. And also, you know, Carrie Fisher was in another one of my favorite movies, When Harry Met Sally, and she's just so good in it. And like iconic, really. And to have like those two roles, even though they're not the same at all, but to be such a, you know, just such an icon in the time that she had on Earth.
She truly phenomenal. Her role in When Harry Met Sally is one of the best B-plot roles of any rom-com.
You're right. Really, you're right. I know you're right.
I mean, yes. What? I've never quoted anyone to anyone before, and now I've quoted you to you?
Right. Isn't that crazy? Don't you think that's crazy? Yeah. Oh, look, I was looking for a red pump.
Such a phenomenal actress.
Exactly.
And, I mean, even to her last parts, she was in, is it Catastrophe? Is that the...
Oh, so good, yeah.
Beautiful. And how they wrote her death into the series was, uh-huh. and gave her a public funeral that she deserved was phenomenal.
Yeah. I was really heartbroken by her, the loss of Carrie Fisher. And like, you know, I think that there are people in my family who are like, what is, it's just a celebrity. Like, and I was just like, you don't understand. She meant a lot to me and I can't explain why. Although I think I am actually explaining why.
Yeah. Did you ever get to see her? I mean, 'cause you're in LA, did mm-hmm. you ever get to see her on a panel?
No, not really. I mean, she would go to Comic-Con. I mean, when she had to, I think, but you know, I mean, there's a whole, you know, she has a very mixed, I speak of her in the present tense because her writing was after her to tell us exactly what she thinks. But she had like a very mixed, mixed feelings toward Star Wars. And she had a whole show where she talked about it. She called it Wishful Drinking was the name of the show. It was an yep. HBO one woman show. And she talked about like all of the, you know, like sex dolls and slave Leia outfits and all of that stuff that was right. made with her likeness. And, you know, obviously she doesn't, you know, she didn't look like that. She looked like that when she was 18 and 19 and 20. And yeah. then she didn't look like that anymore. And so like, if you can imagine what the internet would have done with that, it would have been rough. And she said, even when she was hired back for the final three movies, when she went out, started going on talk shows with her dog, Gary Fisher.
yes.
When she started going talk shows with Gary, she started talking about how like, she's like, it's great that they want to hire me, but they only want to hire like 3/4 of me. And so that then she would have to go on a massive, you know, reduction diet in order to lose enough to play the character that she already was, you know?
Yeah.
So that was, you know, but she always kind of like gave a big F you to Hollywood, which is just always, it's always very brave when somebody can do that. And I think that, you know, she, so when you asked me before about like what is in my area of influences, two books that have come up that I didn't know existed until I kind of had this, my interest in Carrie Fisher and in Star Wars renewed in advance of the new set of three. It was a book called Princess of Alderaan, which was a prequel to Star Wars that explains when Leia was like, you know, 16 and growing up on Alderaan and expected to be the princess and her relationship with her parents, which, as we know from watching the movies, they're not actually her birth parents, you know. But, you know, she has love for her father. And then that kind of like imbues the whole explosion of Alderaan scene in Star Wars as, and A New Hope as like actually more meaningful, because we had never heard of Alderaan until that moment. We just know it's her home planet. So this kind of builds a whole life and society on Alderaan that she is responsible for taking care of as a princess, but also as a senator. And she does a lot of diplomatic missions. So, you know, it's like you got a little bit more of it was still like core Leia, kind of like not, you know, not dissolving right into a puddle when she likes a guy, you know. It was still strongly Leia, like she felt something, but like it wasn't like it didn't paralyze her or render her unable to fulfill her mission, you know. So just I really just think that was remarkable. And then there's okay. a book called Bloodlines. Both of them are by the same author, Claudia Gray, and Bloodlines talks about her as not as slave Leia, you know, the one who was imprisoned by Jabba the Hutt, but as Hutt Slayer. And that's how she's known in the universe, because she killed the Jabba the Hutt. And so, like, you know, instead of being known for a bikini, she's known for an act of resistance and killing the bad guy. So, like, I love that they kind of recast that. And I think that's kind of what I was always missing, is that, like, I felt like there was a lot of independence and training and knowledge and just intellectual capacity that we saw a little bit of from Leia, but couldn't really focus on because there was too much action going on. And so this kind of retconning is something that I just really appreciated.
And in your sequence of watching them, did you find out about the two? So the final trilogy gets announced, but isn't it the final trilogy plus one? Were there five modern Star Wars movies? Doesn't matter.
Right. So there were two additional standalones One, which was like kind of like the 5 minutes or so before A New Hope starts. Yep. I mean, because it's all the story. It's based on like one line, and this is kind of where I can make it Jewy again.
Please if you do. Don't mind. I didn't invite you to this podcast to make it Protestant.
I know. I'm glad I'm living up to expectations. Yeah, I mean, so there is this one line in the original Star Wars in A New Hope where they talk about how, you know, thousands of people died to get these plans to the rebellions, to the resistance. And Rogue One is the entire story of all of those people who died, and well, not all of them, but like the core team that got the plans and delivered the plans.
So it's the Mishnah?
So it's basically, it's a Midrash.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what it is. It's like, who were these people and what did they do and how did they get the plans to where they are at the beginning of A New Hope? So that was interesting. And that was kind of, you know, I really liked it. They did use like a CGI Princess Leia at the end, which I wasn't a fan of. It was like the uncanny valley. It didn't look real. But, you know, she's still a character who I'm happy to see, especially when I wasn't expecting it. So that was it packed an emotional punch, but it was also kind of like made me feel weird, like a little bit queasy. I think at that point she had died a couple of months. Carrie Fisher had died a couple of months before that. And so I felt like, you know, it was good to see her again. So I know that's weird. But like my I feel very connected to her, apparently.
So what I meant to ask before I fact-checked how many modern movies there were was, so you have these two novels. You've got Princess of Alderaan and Bloodlines and the modern trilogy. Did you, what was your order of encountering the books in the new movies? Did you read these books, get a new understanding for Leia, and then go into the modern trilogy? Or like, maybe they came out and overlapped?
They overlapped. They were supposed to provide you with some kind of background in advance of The Force Awakens. So that's kind of when the first new movie. So that's kind of when Bloodlines, I think, had been around for a while, but But the Princess of Alderaan, I think, ended up setting up some things that happen in, not some things that happen, but like some characters. So like the Laura Dern character in The Force Awakens, right?
Yeah, she's got like purple hair, and she's the one who saves the ship and gets everybody else off the ship, right? Or she tells your plan was dumb. I told you your plan was dumb, and now I have to save you by dying.
Yeah, I think it's The Last Jedi, actually. I think it's the middle movie. But yeah, so Holdo appears in as one of Leia's friends from growing up. To understand that they have like a deep, you know, connection to each other, that they've known each other for a very long time. You know, that actually adds to your understanding of their scene where they're connecting and kind of communicating with one another without actually saying much.
Okay.
So there's a backstory. And knowing that backstory kind of imbues a moment with more emotion. So things like that, I really appreciated. If I didn't have them, I would be fine with the narrative.
Sure.
But, you know, having those extra shadings of nuance are important. You know, more than you know somebody, the more you can feel for them.
We've talked about Midrash. We've already gotten a little Jewy. Does your love of Star Wars impact either, you watch a lot of TV and pop culture for work, so there's a lot of things you're consuming because that is what you do for a living, mm-hmm. but do you see Star Wars impacting other pop culture choices you get to make on your own? Or if you write fiction or you're writing stories, do you see Star Wars impacting other work that you do?
Absolutely. I mean, I wrote a piece for modernloss.com about loss and how, and basically talking about, you said your friends on the podcast. I know that they're not your friends, but I know your podcast friends are your friends. I've read that. I read that piece you wrote. So,
yes.
so, you know, they talk about what's the right order to watch things in. And there's something called the Machete Order, which is named after a blog called the Machete Blog, but it also happens to carve up the order so that you watch it kind of in it kind of cuts the story up and rearranges it. So you would watch Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back up until the, you know, Luke, I am your father moment. And then the people are going, what? He's your father? How did that happen? And then you go like back to the prequels to show you how that happened, and then skip back to Return of the Jedi to finish out that thing. And then ahead to the new movies that then close out the 9 movie loop. Does that make sense?
Full arc. Yeah.
So I used that as a jumping off point to talk about loss and how loss can be nonlinear, and how, you know, if you're in the middle of something that's traumatic, that your brain can send you shooting back to the past, and then back to the future, and then back to the past again. And so basically just about the nonlinear nature of grief. And I think that, you know, a lot of people were like, some people read it and were like, this is exactly it. Other people are like, I don't know Star Wars enough to understand what you're talking about, but like, which happens to me quite a bit. But, you know, I thought it was a really interesting metaphor. The idea also that the Force, you know, as Obi-Wan Kenobi, AKA Ben, says in the first movie, he says that the Force is something that runs through us. It penetrates us and binds the galaxy together. So talk about like collective responsibility, and that we're all in this universe together. I live in LA now, where everybody talks about the universe and manifesting and all of that stuff all the time. But the idea that we're all kind of connected through some cosmic energy is something that I don't disagree with, in terms of how we should view our responsibility, which is like very much, you know, of this moment, like, you know, wearing masks and just being considerate of our neighbors. Like, we have to do that.
It's true. It's that the Force as a collective energy of like people working together to harness something for good or for evil. Absolutely is this time we're in, mm-hmm. on both aspects, on both the COVID and I think COVID, wearing a mask, taking care of your neighbors, even though they're strangers, and also on Black Lives Matter of looking at the world and the system we're in and how can we change that system. I think the forces, it's not a cotton candy metaphor. It's mm-hmm. It's a very useful metaphor for the time we live in.
I agree. And there's the moment where, like I said before, the planet of Alderaan gets blown up. I'm sorry if this is a spoiler, but the movie came out in 1977. So if you haven't seen it by now,
right.
I think it's okay. So when Alderaan explodes and then, you know, I don't even know how far away on the Millennium Falcon, Obi-Wan Kenobi is visibly shaken and he needs to sit down and they ask him what's wrong. And he says, I feel like millions of souls just cried out in terror and were suddenly silenced. And I've thought of that over and over again as, you know, as I remember when I was in New York, I was living in New York and it's 9/11 and watching those towers fall, that's what I felt. And like, even as the, you know, as the, there was a shooting in Las Vegas, you know, a couple of years ago, yep. If you remember that, when we used to have mass shootings and that was our big problem. So I remember watching the footage of the number of dead just elevate, just keep going up.
Yeah.
And whenever there's any kind of like mass incident, I feel that kind of like deep pain and dread. And so I relate to that. And I feel like, in some ways that's it. The Jedi, you know, the Jedi and the Sith, the good guys and the bad guys are connected in terms of the kinds of powers that they have. But the Jedi are more empathic and the Sith are more, lean more toward anger, revenge, selfishness and greed. Whereas the Jedi are more about like humanity. And I mean, everybody's still soldiers. It's like complicated, but you know, the Jedi are really supposed to be about like, you know, preserving the Force and making sure we all kind of like stay connected to each other. Feeling of interconnectedness and builds empathy, which is more the realm of the Jedi than it is for the Sith, who would use knowledge of other people's emotions to exploit and to tempt, as opposed to connect and heal.
It's really, you know, a battle of like narcissism, which is a manipulative way of living in the world, of looking at people, identifying their weaknesses and turning that on them, that being bad. I flip the order, and the Force as recognizing people's weaknesses and trying to hold space for them.
Yeah.
And like allow that weakness to get stronger or help people educate themselves or give them the food or the housing or whatever it is they need to build on that weakness and not manipulate it and crush the person.
Right. And for each, for the Sith and the Jedi, see the strengths of the other as their weakness.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I think it's the Emperor says to Luke, or Luke says to the Emperor when he's battling him, or 1983. So like, you know, you should have seen this already, but I think the line is something like, your overconfidence is your weakness. And, the Emperor says your belief in your friends is yours. You know, in some ways friends can be a distraction. People that you love are a distraction. Luke leaves his training with Yoda because his friends are in trouble and he wasn't ready to face Darth Vader, but he did. And so like, you know, I think that there's all of these things that you could talk about, whether, you know, whether empathy is something that makes you weaker or stronger, because, you know, depending on where you fall out on that issue, you might be a Jedi or you might be a Sith. Sorry to tell you.
I wonder how many Harvard Business Review articles are about that. Like
Sith versus Jedi? Or empathy.
I mean, empathy is like a gajillion, probably. But it's such a hot topic right now, the idea of empathy. And I think there's so much to learn from like the idea that are your friends a distraction or are they your strength? I think with or without Luke Skywalker, like friends are your strength.
Mm-hmm. of the things that I really love about this universe, and really is like in a galaxy far, far away, but it's like a whole universe of characters and situations, et cetera, is that I love the creativity it inspires in its fans. I love...
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, there's this series called Looking for Leia that was all about women in the Star Wars fandom, which was really mind-blowing and just really... so special because there weren't that many women in the Star Wars universe when the first movie came out. And then as the properties have expanded, there have been many, many more women, both Jedi and Sith. And so like, that's really important too, to show the balance on both sides and, you know, pay equity at the, you know, at the Death Star, you know, kind of thing. But, you know, I love that. I love the way people like take on characters and dress up at Comic-Con. I love the parodies, you know, everything from early, there was a parody called Hardware Wars, which I don't know if you ever saw.
No,
but
tell me.
I think it's just a short film. It was like as a kind of like a pre-film on like one of the video cassettes that we got, I remember. And it was basically all of the space things from Star Wars replaced with household objects like frying pans and irons and like just it was so weird, but it was like it was just funny. And then
that suddenly sounds very familiar.
I'm sure you saw it, like, you know, we're I'm a couple years ahead of you, but I think it was probably something that you saw and maybe it didn't register. Then there's also Spaceballs and you know, somebody, there was even like a short film that I later met the guy who created it. I'm out here randomly, because I happened to be at a party at his house and I looked on the wall and there was like a poster of this and I'm like, I love that movie. He goes, I made that movie. And it's called Lucas in Love, which was an imagining of how George Lucas, got the inspiration for Star Wars. And it's like, you know, George Lucas at college. And he like meets a girl who has headphones on, like I have on. He's like, and she takes it off, and they're kind of like the buns for Princess Leia. And so it's just like, you know, kind of like all of these threads that if you know the series, you'll see. But it was modeled kind of on Shakespeare in Love. So that was also like, I liked it. Like it was like a dual concept that really resonated with me.
I love it.
Yeah.
It does seem like George Lucas has a good sense of humor.
Well, funny you should mention that, because he did until he made those prequels. And then I think he lost his possibly mind, but also possibly sense of humor, which, you know, there have been so many documentaries about Star Wars things. But the one that I'm thinking of now is called The People versus George Lucas, which is about how the fans turned on him after those prequels.
Right.
And it's really interesting to watch because they have these super fans who are like, I was super excited and I went to the movie theater. And at the end, I was like, huh, that was bad, right? And then they were like, I don't know, I must have missed it. Like, I'm going to go see it again.
Yeah.
I went to see it again. And they're like, no, that was not good. I did not enjoy that. And so like, you know, that kind of, and then like, I think people even like tried to sue him. Like, it was just like a whole, on the smaller level of it, it's not like, it's not important.
Right.
But it is also like super important to specific people. So, you know, I mean, you asked me before what kind of Star Wars fan I am. And, you know, I said that I wasn't Orthodox, but I did manage to go to Comic-Con and see that kind of level of devotion, but felt a little bit like I shouldn't be there. Like I wasn't a real fan compared to these other people. But I also just have always had like these very emotional reactions to Star Wars. The John Williams score is like, it just gets me every time I start. It's like somebody did one of those, you know, clear and then like just restarted my heart. Mm-hmm. It's like crazy physical sensation.
So you have a Pavlovian response.
Absolutely.
A John Williams score. Yeah,
absolutely. And Let's see. I also like, I was able to go to the Lucasfilm campus in San Francisco, and I was basically crying every 5 minutes. I was like so unprofessional. Like, there's this fountain outside with Yoda in it, and I saw it, and yeah. I started crying. And then like I saw the movie artifacts and the costumes, and I started crying more. And then like I got it together. And then I was there with Maya Mbialik, who I was working for at the time at Grok Nation, and she was taping an episode of the Star Wars show, which is a web series that is based at Lucasfilm, and we all jammed into this little room that was packed to the gills with the Star Wars action figures of all kinds. And I'm literally in the corner just like looking at them and weeping. Yeah. And at some point it was kind of like almost audible while they were recording. And I was just like, I got to get it together. I'm not being, I knew it was just an office that people went to every day. But for me, it was like a once in a lifetime thing. It was like a holy pilgrimage.
And it was pre-Disney.
I think it was post. It was just a couple of years ago. I think
maybe. I don't have a sense of when Disney happened. I just know that Disney reorganized a lot of the things that had been made and said, this is now canon. This is now legend.
Right.
But I guess they would need more than 2 years to build the theme park part of Star Wars. So it would have to be more than 2 years for sure.
Right. And I actually ended up at Disneyland. It was my first visit ever when my nieces were in town in December. But, you know, I did go to they had a Star Wars ride open when I was there called Smuggler's Run, which was one of those hydraulic kind of like you sit and then swerve to right and left and up and down. And the screen in front of you makes you think like you're going over a cliff. And like, I've never really enjoyed those because, you know, I have kind of a delicate balance to my system. And, but I was like, I can't not go.
Yeah.
I can't not smuggle things in the Millennium Falcon since I'm here. So I did it and I'm glad I did it. And I would probably even do it again, quite honestly, but I wouldn't say I enjoyed it.
Fair.
I felt like this is just a you know, kind of confirming for me that I'm not built for space travel, but I like to believe I would be able to smuggle things with Han Solo on a smuggling mission, but like I probably could not.
I think if you were on the real Millennium Falcon, you would be able to tell yourself, I'm like, you've been on turbulent airplanes before.
I have not enjoyed it, by the way. But I knew that's this fair. Was on the ground. I knew this was like not dangerous. Like that was helpful. It wasn't comfortable, but it wasn't dangerous. I'd like to think I'm a Leia, but I'm probably a 3PO. And like, I'm kind of like being like, we're doomed. I feel like I'm a protocol droid. And, I'm like skilled at communication, but like, anxious about and terrified about everything.
I mean, it's a realistic self-portrait, I guess. I would whoever it is in Star Wars that just stays home and just who are the people that stay home? They probably blow up in Alderaan. I don't know who I would be in Star Wars. Like I do well in emergencies, but I'm not like a. I would like trip and fall very early and then limp and be slow. And so like, I don't think you actually want me in battle. I think you want me behind the battle. So how often do you throw a Star Wars movie on for comfort food?
I don't really throw it on. But if it is on, I may watch it. I knew I wanted to see Rise of Skywalker again, which was the last movie. I only saw it once in the theaters, and I read a whole bunch of commentary that made me like want to look at it again. So I did that. That's a process I enjoy, is like reading Midrash and then going back to the original.
Yeah.
So that's Midrash being Jewish legend, if we didn't define that before. But you know, the idea that there's more to something than just the text is interesting to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, people talking about a person who appeared and hugged another person, and that was a nod to the other thing. And I was just like, I did not see any of that. And part of that is because that last movie was just jam-packed full of too much on the screen to watch at any one time. So, you know, what comes out in the second viewing is really important. And, you know, to make that joy again, let's just talk about how every Simchat Torah, we go back and read the Torah again, because we are different from the last time we read it, even though the text stays the same. So I think you know, all pieces of art that are resonant to you are worth revisiting to see how you respond to them as you develop and mature as a human. So that's something that I've really enjoyed doing. And still, you know, reading ever more G things into the content has also been like something that I've been, you know, doing. I've done a couple of panels with my Muslim and Christian friends who also are Star Wars fans, and we talk about the spirituality in it and what it meant for us personally from our own spiritual framework to be in this universe and observing these things. And that's been fascinating. I think that there's just like so many opportunities through culture to build bridges, and I'm just always happy to do that through narrative and story.
I love it. Is there anything I haven't asked you about Star Wars that I would be remiss in saying thank you without you sharing?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things. One of the things is that, you know, my brother had all the action figures growing up.
Yep.
And so, like, some of those characters don't have actual names they're not named on screen, but they're named for the purposes of sales. So like you could see Hammerhead had like kind of a head, like a Hammerhead shirt.
Oh, I remember Hammerhead. That is for sure one that either my brother or Josh Bell had.
Right.
Who was our neighbor with all the toys.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's always one of them. I think it was probably my brother for the neighborhood though. And you know, Greedo he's green and he's greedy. So like, you know, I get that. There's a character named Reese, R-E-E-Y-E-E-S, and he has three eyes.
Okay.
And if you do the anagramming, like you can see Reese and three eyes in there.
Yep.
And I also took a vocabulary test once, and I knew the word Rancor because it's the name of like the super nasty beast that lives under the floor in Jabba's palace in Return of the Jedi. So like, you know, those kinds of things, you could say it's educational. But I liked the way they played with the language. I liked the way they kind of had symbolic names for some people. And that's even before I start adding a Jewy layer of interpretation.
Absolutely, Lucas, a Leia.
Yeah.
Well, I guess George Lucas, Luke, that's pretty obvious.
Yes, yes. Luke S. He's Luke Skywalker, Lucas, Luke S.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I am today years old when I realized that.
Yeah. Well, even in the previous version of it, of his script, he had talked about Luke Starkiller wasn't his original name, but it was still Luke S. And
Skywalker is a much better name than Starkiller.
Right. And if they're not going to give me a reason why somebody got their name, I'm going to certainly infer it.
Absolutely.
Like the name Yoda is very close in Hebrew to the verb for knowledge, which is Yodea. And yada and meda, information, knowledge. Yoda, yodea, Yoda knows. Ben Kenobi, you know, with Benjamin, you can say what you want about Benjamin, but an Obi-Wan is certainly a nod to, like, you know, the Kurosawa films that I believe George Lucas was a big fan of. But Kenobi, it sounds like Kenavi, like as a prophet. And so I feel like, you know, I don't think that George Lucas meant that, but the way I read it is like, you know, it's just like when somebody paints a picture, you know, and does a painting, right? And it's in a museum, and they could call it like unknown number three or whatever the story is, or they could call it, you know, repose. And you can just look at it and you might have one clue, repose, but then you would like look at it and say, well, that's not how it's resonating with me. It almost looks like unrest, or it looks like turmoil, or it looks, you know, for me, it seems to be like somebody wants to do something and somebody else doesn't want them to. So seeing those kinds of interpreting those kinds of tensions into a work of art, I think is a remarkable opportunity for deeper understanding and analysis and cultural exploration. And I'm just so happy to have these films and, you know, the things that are being produced today. There's just so much so much content, period. Even some of it great. and, you know, just kind of exploring stories of how people get to be who they are. It's fascinating.
Great. Well, Esther, thank you so much for joining me
A pleasure.
This evening in Chicago, afternoon in Los Angeles.
Yeah, well, it's almost evening now. Yeah. But I'm always happy to come back another time. I could develop another favorite thing if you'd like.
Well, we covered two favorite things that season two. It could have been season two, yes. I mean, I hope there's not a season two of The Quarantine, but I think it's I'm having a lot of fun doing these interviews, and I think it's an idea that I can stick with for a couple years.
Excellent. I look forward to listening.
Thank you. So where can people find you online? How should people follow up with you?
My sometimes not updated website is esterk.com. And you can always find me on Twitter at esterk, on Instagram at esterkostanowitz. And I am on the Facebook, but I believe my friend roster is full. So I'm considering creating a author page or something like that. But anyway, just you can always Google me and find all my stuff.
Yeah. And people can follow TV Ganjui on Facebook. If they can't friend you, they can follow that project.
For sure.
And they can subscribe to your podcast.
Yes, The Bagel Report.
The Bagel Report.
Yes. It's fun. We took a couple of weeks off right after the Black Lives Matter protests started because we felt like we needed to step back and let other voices be heard. But we're hopefully coming back to you real soon.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for this, and have a good evening. And may the force be with you.
And with you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.